Are you all right?
Mariam's face, engraved with scratches, heavy with worry, hovered over Layla. Layla tried a breath. It burned her throat. She tried another. It burned even more this time, and not just her throat, but her chest, too. And then she was coughing and wheezing, gasping, but breathing. Her good ear rang. The first thing she saw when she sat up was Rashid. He was lying on his back, staring at nothing, with an unblinking, fish-mouthed expression. A bit of foam, lightly pink, had dribbled from his mouth down his cheek. The front of his pants was wet. She saw his forehead. Then she saw the shovel. A groan came out of her. "Oh," she said, tremulously, barely able to make a voice. "Oh, Mariam." Layla paced, moaning and banging her hands together, as Mariam sat near Rashid, her hands in her lap, calm and motionless. Mariam didn't say anything for a long time. Layla's mouth was dry, and she was stammering her words, trembling all over. She willed herself not to look at Rashid, at the rictus of his mouth, his open eyes, at the blood congealing in the hollow of his collarbone. Outside, the light was fading, the shadows deepening. Mariam's face looked thin and drawn in this light. But she did not appear agitated or frightened, merely preoccupied, thoughtful, so self-possessed that when a fly landed on her chin, she paid it no attention. She just sat there, with her bottom lip stuck out, the way she did when she was absorbed in thought. At last she said, "Sit down, Layla Jo." Layla did obediently. "We have to move him. Zalmai can't see this." Mariam fished the bedroom key from Rashid's pocket before they wrapped him in a bedsheet. Layla took him by the legs, behind the knees, and Mariam grabbed him under the arms. They tried lifting him, but he was too heavy, and they ended up dragging him. As they were passing through the front door and into the yard, Rashid's foot caught against the doorframe and his leg bent sideways. They had to back up and try again, and then something thumped upstairs and Layla's legs gave out. She dropped Rashid. She slumped to the ground, sobbing and shaking, and Mariam had to stand over her, hands on hips, and say that she had to get herself together. That what was done was done. After a time, Layla got up and wiped her face, and they carried Rashid to the yard without further incident. They took him into the tool shed. They left him behind the workbench, on which sat his saw, some nails, a chisel, a hammer, and a cylindrical block of wood that Rashid had been meaning to carve into something for Zalmai, but had never gotten around to doing. Then they went back inside. Mariam washed her hands, ran them through her hair, took a deep breath, and let it out. "Let me tend to your wounds now. You're all cut up, Layla Jo." Mariam said she needed the night to think things over, to get her thoughts together and devise a plan. "There is a way," she said, "and I just have to find it."
"We have to leave. We can't stay here," Layla said in a broken, husky voice.
She thought suddenly of the sound the shovel must have made striking Rashid's head, and her body pitched forward. Bile surged up her chest. Mariam waited patiently until Layla felt better. Then she had Layla lie down, and as she stroked Layla's hair in her lap, Mariam said not to worry, that everything would be fine. She said that they would leave, she, Layla, the children, and Tariq too. They would leave this house and this unforgiving city. They would leave this despondent country altogether, Mariam said, running her hands through Layla's hair, and go someplace remote and safe where no one would find them, where they could disown their past and find shelter. "Somewhere with trees," she said. "Yes, lots of trees." They would live in a small house on the edge of some town they'd never heard of, Mariam said, or in a remote village where the road was narrow and unpaved, but lined with all manner of plants and shrubs. Maybe there would be a path to take, a path that led to a grass field where the children could play, or maybe a graveled road that would take them to a clear blue lake where trout swam and reeds poked through the surface.
They would raise sheep and chickens, and they would make bread together and teach the children to read. They would make new lives for themselves, peaceful, solitary lives. And there the weight of all that they'd endured would lift from them, and they would be deserving of all the happiness and simple prosperity they would find. Lila murmured encouragingly. It would be an existence rife with difficulties, she saw, but of a pleasurable kind, difficulties they could take pride in, possess, value, as one would a family heirloom. Mariam's soft maternal voice went on, brought a degree of comfort to her. There is a way, she'd said. And in the morning, Mariam would tell her what needed to be done, and they would do it. And maybe by tomorrow this time, they would be on their way to this new life, a life luxuriant with possibility and joy and welcome difficulties. Lila was grateful that Mariam was in charge, unclouded and sober, able to think this through for both of them. Her own mind was a jittery, muddled mess. Mariam got up. You should tend to your son now. On her was the most stricken expression Lila had ever seen on a human face. Lila found him in the dark, curled up on Rashid's side of the mattress. She slipped beneath the covers beside him and pulled the blanket over them. Are you asleep? Without turning around to face her, he said, Can't sleep yet. Baba John hasn't said the Babalu prayers with me. Maybe I can say them with you tonight. You can't say them like he can. She squeezed his little shoulder, kissed the nape of his neck. I can try. Where is Baba John? Baba John has gone away, Lila said, her throat closing up again. And there it was, spoken for the first time, the great damning lie. How many more times would this lie have to be told? Lila wondered miserably. How many more times would Zalmai have to be deceived? She pictured Zalmai, his jubilant running welcomes when Rashid came home, and Rashid picking him up by the elbows and swinging him round and round until Zalmai's legs flew straight out, the two of them giggling afterward when Zalmai stumbled around like a drunk. She thought of their disorderly games and their boisterous laughs, their secretive glances. A pall of shame and grief for her son fell over Lila. Where did he go? I don't know, my love. When was he coming back? Would Baba John bring a present with him when he returned? She did the prayers with Zalmai. 21 Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, one for each knuckle of 7 fingers. She watched him cup his hands before his face and blow into them, then place the back of both hands on his forehead and make a casting away motion, whispering, Babalu, be gone. Do not come to Zalmai. He has no business with you. Babalu, be gone. Then to finish off, they said Allahu Akbar 3 times. And later, much later that night, Lila was startled by a muted voice. Did Baba John leave because of me? Because of what I said about you and the man downstairs? She leaned over him, meaning to reassure, meaning to say, it had nothing to do with you, Zalmai. No, nothing is your fault. But he was asleep, his small chest rising and sinking. When Lila went to bed, her mind was muffled up, clouded, incapable of sustained, rational thought. But when she woke up to the muezzin's call for morning prayer, much of the dullness had lifted. She sat up and watched Zalmai sleep for a while, the ball of his fist under his chin. Lila pictured Mariam sneaking into the room in the middle of the night as she and Zalmai had slept, watching them, making plans in her head. Lila slipped out of bed. It took effort to stand. She ached everywhere, her neck, her shoulders, her back, her arms, her thighs, all engraved with the cuts of Rashid's belt buckle. Wincing, she quietly left the bedroom. In Mariam's room, the light was a shade darker than gray, the kind of light Lila had always associated with crowing roosters and dew rolling off blades of grass. Mariam was sitting in a corner, on a prayer rug, facing the window. Slowly, Lila lowered herself to the ground, sitting down across from her. You should go and visit Aziza this morning, Mariam said. I know what you mean to do.
Don't walk, take the bus, you'll blend in. You're sure to get stopped for riding alone.
What you promised last night?
Lila could not finish. The trees, the lake, the nameless village. A delusion, she saw. A lovely lie meant to soothe. Like cooing to a distressed child.
I meant it, Mariam said. I meant it for you, Lila Jo.
I don't want any of it without you, Lila croaked.
Mariam smiled wanly.
I want it to be just like you said, Mariam. All of us going together. You, me, the children. Tariq has a place in Pakistan. We can hide out there for a while, wait for things to calm down.
That's not possible, Mariam said patiently, like a parent to a well-meaning but misguided child.
We'll take care of each other, Lila said, choking on the words, her eyes wet with tears. Like you said.
No, I'll take care of you for a change.
Oh, Lila Jo.
Lila went on a stammering rant. She bargained, she promised. She would do all the cleaning, she said, and all the cooking.
You won't have to do a thing, ever again. You rest, sleep in, plant a garden. Whatever you want, you ask, and I'll get it for you.
Don't do this, Mariam. Don't leave me. Don't break Aziza's heart.
They chop off hands for stealing bread, Mariam said. What do you think they'll do when they find a dead husband and two missing wives?
No one will know, Lila breathed. No one will find us.
They will. Sooner or later, they're bloodhounds.
Mariam's voice was low, cautioning. It made Lila's promises sound fantastical, trumped up, foolish.
Mariam, please.
When they do, they'll find you as guilty as me. Tariq, too. I won't have the two of you living on the run like fugitives.
What will happen to your children if you're caught?
Tears brimming Lila's eyes, stinging.
Who will take care of them then? The Taliban?
Think like a mother, Lila Jo. Think like a mother.
I am.
I can't.
You have to.
It isn't fair, Lila croaked.
But it is. Come here. Come, lie here.
Lila crawled to her, and again put her head on Mariam's lap. She remembered all the afternoons they'd spent together, braiding each other's hair, Mariam listening patiently to her random thoughts and ordinary stories with an air of gratitude, with the expression of a person to whom a unique and coveted privilege had been extended.
It is fair, Mariam said. I've killed our husband. I've deprived your son of his father. It isn't right that I run. I can't. Even if they never catch us, I'll never... Her lips trembled. I'll never escape your son's grief. How do I look at him? How do I ever bring myself to look at him, Lila Jo?
Mariam twiddled a strand of Lila's hair, untangled a stubborn curl.
For me, it ends here. There's nothing more I want. Everything I ever wished for as a little girl, you've already given me. You and your children have made me so very happy. It's all right, Lila Jo. This is all right. Don't be sad.
Lila could find no reasonable answer for anything Mariam said. But she rambled on anyway, incoherently, childishly, about the fruit trees that awaited planting and chickens that awaited raising. She went on about small houses in unnamed towns, and walks to trout-filled lakes. And in the end, when the words dried up, the tears did not. And all Lila could do was surrender and sob like a child overwhelmed by an adult's unassailable logic. All she could do was roll herself up and bury her face one last time in the welcoming warmth of Mariam's lap. Later that morning, Mariam packed Zaimai a small lunch of bread and dried figs. For Aziza, too, she packed some figs and a few cookies shaped like animals. She put it all in a paper bag and gave it to Lila.
Kiss Aziza for me, she said. Tell her she's the nur of my eyes and the sultan of my heart. Will you do that for me?
Lila nodded, her lips pursed together. Take the bus, like I said, and keep your head low.
When will I see you, Mariam? I want to see you before I testify. I'll tell them how it happened. I'll explain that it wasn't your fault, that you had to do it. They'll understand, won't they, Mariam? They'll understand.
Mariam gave her a soft look. She hunkered down to eye level with Zalmay. He was wearing a red t-shirt, ragged khakis, and a used pair of cowboy boots Rashid had bought him from Mandayi. He was holding his new basketball with both hands. Mariam planted a kiss on his cheek.
You be a good, strong boy now, she said. You treat your mother well.
She cupped his face. He pulled back, but she held on. I'm so sorry, Zalmayjo. Believe me that I'm so very sorry for all your pain and sadness. Layla held Zalmay's hand as they walked down the road together. Just before they turned the corner, Layla looked back and saw Mariam at the door. Mariam was wearing a white scarf over her head, a dark blue sweater buttoned in the front, and white cotton trousers. A crest of gray hair had fallen loose over her brow. Bars of sunlight slashed across her face and shoulders. Mariam waved amiably. They turned the corner, and Layla never saw Mariam again. Mariam. Back in a kolba, it seemed, after all these years, the Waloyat Women's Prison was a drab, square-shaped building in Chardinau near Chicken Street. It sat in the center of a larger complex that housed male inmates. A padlocked door separated Mariam and the other women from the surrounding men. Mariam counted 5 working cells. There were unfurnished rooms with dirty, peeling walls and small windows that looked into the courtyard. The windows were barred, even though the doors to the cells were unlocked and the women were free to come and go to the courtyard as they pleased. The windows had no glass. There were no curtains either, which meant the Talib guards who roamed the courtyard had an eyeful of the interior of the cells. Some of the women complained that the guards smoked outside the window and leered in, with their inflamed eyes and wolfish smiles, that they muttered indecent jokes to each other about them. Because of this, most of the women wore burqas all day and lifted them only after sundown, after the main gate was locked and the guards had gone to their posts. At night, the cell Mariam shared with 5 women and 4 children was dark. On those nights when there was electrical power, they hoisted Naghma, a short, flat-chested girl with black frizzy hair, up to the ceiling. There was a wire there from which the coating had been stripped. Naghma would hand-wrap the life wire around the base of the light bulb then to make a circuit. The toilets were closet-sized, the cement floor cracked. There was a small, rectangular hole in the ground, at the bottom of which was a heap of feces. Flies buzzed in and out of the hole. In the middle of the prison was an open, rectangular courtyard and, in the middle of that, a well. The well had no drainage, meaning the courtyard was often a swamp and the water tasted rotten. Laundry lines, loaded with hand-washed socks and diapers, slashed across each other in the courtyard. This was where inmates met visitors, where they boiled the rice their families brought them. The prison provided no food. The courtyard was also the children's playground. Mariam had learned that many of the children had been born in Velayat, had never seen the world outside these walls. Mariam watched them chase each other around, watched their shoeless feet sling mud. All day they ran around, making up lively games, unaware of the stench of feces and urine that permeated Velayat and their own bodies, unmindful of the Talib guards until one smacked them. Mariam had no visitors. That was the first and only thing she had asked the Talib officials here. No visitors. None of the women in Mariam's cell were serving time for violent crime. They were all there for the common offense of running away from home. As a result, Mariam gained some notoriety among them, became a kind of celebrity. The women eyed her with a reverent, almost awestruck expression. They offered her their blankets, they competed to share their food with her.
The most avid was Naghma, who was always hugging her elbows and following Maryam everywhere she went. Naghma was the sort of person who found it entertaining to dispense news of misfortune, whether others or her own. She said her father had promised her to a tailor some 30 years older than her. "He smells like go and has fewer teeth than fingers," Naghma said of the tailor. She tried to elope to Gardez with a young man she'd fallen in love with, the son of a local mullah. They'd barely made it out of Kabul. When they were caught and sent back, the mullah's son was flogged before he repented and said that Naghma had seduced him with her feminine charms. She'd cast a spell on him, he said. He promised he would rededicate himself to the study of Quran. The mullah's son was freed. Naghma was sentenced to 5 years. It was just as well, she said, her being in prison. Her father had sworn that the day she was released, he would take a knife to her throat. Listening to Naghma, Maryam remembered the dim glimmer of cold stars and the stringy, pink clouds streaking over the Safedko Mountains that long ago morning when Nana had said to her, "Like a compass needle that points north, a man's accusing finger always finds a woman. Always. You remember that, Maryam." Maryam's trial had taken place the week before. There was no legal counsel, no public hearing, no cross-examining of evidence, no appeals. Maryam declined her right to witnesses. The entire thing lasted less than 15 minutes. The middle judge, a brittle-looking talib, was the leader. He was strikingly gaunt, with yellow, leathery skin and a curly red beard. He wore eyeglasses that magnified his eyes and revealed how yellow the whites were. His neck looked too thin to support the intricately wrapped turban on his head. "You admit to this, Hamshira?" he asked again in a tired voice. "I do," Maryam said. The man nodded, or maybe he didn't. It was hard to tell. He had a pronounced shaking of his hands and head that reminded Maryam of Mullah Faizullah's tremor. When he sipped tea, he did not reach for his cup. He motioned to the square-shouldered man to his left, who respectfully brought it to his lips. After, the talib closed his eyes gently, a muted and elegant gesture of gratitude. Maryam found a disarming quality about him. When he spoke, it was with a tinge of guile and tenderness. His smile was patient. He did not look at Maryam despisingly. He did not address her with spite or accusation, but with a soft tone of apology. "Do you fully understand what you're saying?" the bony-faced talib to the judge's right, not the tea-giver, said. This one was the youngest of the three. He spoke quickly and with emphatic, arrogant confidence. He'd been irritated that Maryam could not speak Pashto. He struck Maryam as the sort of quarrelsome young man who relished his authority, who saw offenses everywhere, thought it his birthright to pass judgment. "I do understand," Maryam said. "I wonder," the young talib said. "God has made us differently, you women and us men. Our brains are different. You're not able to think like we can. Western doctors and their science have proven this. This is why we require only one male witness, but two female ones." "I admit to what I did, brother," Maryam said. "But if I hadn't, he would have killed her. He was strangling her." "So you say, but then women swear to all sorts of things all the time." "It's the truth." "Do you have witnesses, other than your ambak?" "I do not," said Maryam. "Well, then," he threw up his hands and snickered. It was the sickly talib who spoke next. "I have a doctor in Peshawar," he said. "A fine young Pakistani fellow. I saw him a month ago, and then again last week. I said, 'Tell me the truth, friend.' And he said to me, 3 months, Mullah Sahib, maybe 6 at most. All God's will, of course." He nodded discreetly at the square-shouldered man on his left and took another sip of the tea he was offered. He wiped his mouth with the back of his tremulous hand. It does not frighten me to leave this life that my only son left 5 years ago. This life that insists we bear sorrow upon sorrow long after we can bear no more. No, I believe I shall gladly take my leave when the time comes. What frightens me, Hamshera, is the day God summons me before him and asks, "Why did you not do as I said, Mullah? Why did you not obey my laws?" How shall I explain myself to him, Hamshera? What will be my defense for not heeding his commands? All I can do, all any of us can do in the time we're granted, is to go on abiding by the laws he has set for us. The clearer I see my end, Hamshera, the nearer I am to the day of my reckoning, the more determined I grow to carry out his word, however painful it may prove. He shifted on his cushion and winced. I believe you when you say that your husband was a man of disagreeable temperament, he resumed, fixing Mariam with his bespectacled eyes, his gaze both stern and compassionate. But I cannot help but be disturbed by the brutality of your action, Hamshera. I am troubled by what you have done. I am troubled that his little boy was crying for him upstairs when you did it. I am tired and dying, and I want to be merciful. I want to forgive you. But when God summons me and says, "But it wasn't for you to forgive, Mullah," what shall I say? His companions nodded and looked at him with admiration. Something tells me you're not a wicked woman, Hamshera, but you have done a wicked thing, and you must pay for this thing you have done. Sharia is not vague on this matter. It says I must send you where I will soon join you myself. Do you understand, Hamshera? Mariam looked down at her hands. She said she did. May Allah forgive you. Before they let her out, Mariam was given a document, told to sign beneath her statement and the mullah's sentence. As the three Taliban watched, Mariam wrote it out, her name. The mim, the re, the ya, and the mim, remembering the last time she'd signed her name to a document 27 years before at Jalil's table, beneath the watchful gaze of another mullah. Mariam spent 10 days in prison. She sat by the window of the cell, watched the prison life in the courtyard. When the summer winds blew, she watched bits of scrap paper ride the currents in a frenzied, corkscrew motion as they were hurled this way and that, high above the prison walls. She watched the winds stir mutiny in the dust, whipping it into violent spirals that ripped through the courtyard. Everyone, the guards, the inmates, the children, Mariam, burrowed their faces in the hook of their elbows, but the dust would not be denied. It made homes of ear canals and nostrils, of eyelashes and skin folds, of the space between molars. Only at dusk did the winds die down, and then if a night breeze blew, it did so timidly, as if to atone for the excesses of its daytime sibling. On Mariam's last day at Velayat, Naghma gave her a tangerine. She put it in Mariam's palm and closed her fingers around it. Then she burst into tears. "You're the best friend I ever had," she said. Mariam spent the rest of the day by the barred window watching the inmates below. Someone was cooking a meal, and a stream of cumin-scented smoke and warm air wafted through the window. Mariam could see the children playing a blindfolded game. Two little girls were singing a rhyme, and Mariam remembered it from her childhood, remembered Jalil singing it to her as they'd sat on a rock, fishing in the stream. "Lily, lily bird bath, sitting on a dirt path, minnow sat on the rim and drank, slipped, and in the water she sank." Mariam had disjointed dreams that last night. She dreamed of pebbles, 11 of them, arranged vertically. Jalil, young again, all winning smiles and dimpled chins and sweat patches, coat flung over his shoulder, come at last to take his daughter away for a ride in his shiny, black Buick Roadmaster. Mullah Faizullah, twirling his rosary beads, walking with her along the stream, their twin shadows gliding on the water and on the grassy banks sprinkled with a blue lavender wild iris that, in this dream, smelt like cloves. She dreamed of Nana in the doorway of the kolba, her voice dim and distant, calling her to dinner as Mariam played in cool, tangled grass where ants crawled and beetles scurried and grasshoppers skipped amid all the different shades of green. The squeak of a wheelbarrow laboring up a dusty path, cowbells clanging, sheep baaing on a hill. On the way to Razni Stadium, Mariam bounced in the bed of the truck as it skidded around potholes and its wheels spat pebbles. The bouncing hurt her tailbone. A young armed talib sat across from her, looking at her. Mariam wondered if he would be the one, this amiable-looking young man with the deep-set bright eyes and slightly pointed face, with a black-nailed index finger drumming the side of the truck. "Are you hungry, mother?" he said. Mariam shook her head. "I have a biscuit. It's good. You can have it if you're hungry. I don't mind." "No, tashakor, brother." He nodded, looked at her benignly. "Are you afraid, mother?" A lump closed off her throat. In a quivering voice, Mariam told him the truth. "Yes, I'm very afraid." "I have a picture of my father," he said. "I don't remember him. He was a bicycle repairman once, I know that much. But I don't remember how he moved, you know, how he laughed, or the sound of his voice." He looked away, then back at Mariam. "My mother used to say that he was the bravest man she knew, like a lion, she'd say. But she told me he was crying like a child the morning the communists took him. I'm telling you so you know that it's normal to be scared. It's nothing to be ashamed of, mother." For the first time that day, Mariam cried a little. Thousands of eyes bore down on her. In the crowded bleachers, necks were craned for the benefit of a better view. Tongues clucked. A murmuring sound rippled through the stadium when Mariam was helped down from the truck. Mariam imagined head shaking when the loudspeaker announced her crime, but she did not look up to see whether they were shaking with disapproval or charity, with reproach or pity. Mariam blinded herself to them all. Earlier that morning, she had been afraid that she would make a fool of herself, that she would turn into a pleading, weeping spectacle. She had feared that she might scream or vomit or even wet herself, that in her last moments she would be betrayed by animal instinct or bodily disgrace. But when she was made to descend from the truck, Mariam's legs did not buckle. Her arms did not flail. She did not have to be dragged. And when she did feel herself faltering, she thought of Zalmay, from whom she had taken the love of his life, whose days now would be shaped by the sorrow of his father's disappearance. And then Mariam's stride steadied and she could walk without protest. An armed man approached her and told her to walk toward the southern goalpost. Mariam could sense the crowd tightening up with anticipation. She did not look up. She kept her eyes to the ground, on her shadow, on her executioner's shadow, trailing hers. Though there had been moments of beauty in it, Mariam knew that life, for the most part, had been unkind to her. But as she walked the final 20 paces, she could not help but wish for more of it. She wished she could see Laila again, wished to hear the clangor of her laugh, to sit with her once more for a pot of choy and leftover halwa under a starlit sky. She mourned that she would never see Aziza grow up, would not see the beautiful young woman that she would one day become, would not get to paint her hands with henna and toss nokal candy at her wedding. She would never play with Aziza's children. She would have liked that very much, to be old and play with Aziza's children. Near the goalpost, the man behind her asked her to stop. Mariam did. Through the crisscrossing grid of the burqa, she saw his shadow arms lift his shadow Kalashnikov. Mariam wished for so much in those final moments. Yet as she closed her eyes, it was not regret any longer, but a sensation of abundant peace that washed over her. She thought of her entry into this world, the harami child of a lowly villager, an unintended thing, a pitiable, regrettable accident. A weed. And yet she was leaving the world as a woman who had loved and been loved back. She was leaving it as a friend, as a companion, a guardian, a mother. A person of consequence at last. No, it was not so bad, Mariam thought, that she should die this way. Not so bad. This was a legitimate end to a life of illegitimate beginnings. Mariam's final thoughts were a few words from the Quran, which she muttered under her breath. He has created the heavens and the earth with the truth. He makes the night cover the day, and makes the day overtake the night. And he has made the sun and the moon subservient. Each one runs on to an assigned term. Now surely he is the mighty, the great forgiver.
Kneel, the Talib said.
O my Lord, forgive and have mercy, for you are the best of the merciful ones.
Kneel here, Hamshera, and look down.
One last time, Mariam did as she was told. Part 4. Tariq has headaches now. Some nights, Laila awakens and finds him on the edge of their bed, rocking, his undershirt pulled over his head. The headaches began in Nasir Bagh, he says, then worsened in prison. Sometimes they make him vomit, blind him in one eye. He says it feels like a butcher's knife, burrowing in one temple, twisting slowly through his brain, then poking out the other side. I can taste the metal even, when they begin. Sometimes Laila wets a cloth and lays it on his forehead, and that helps a little. The little round white pills Saeed's doctor gave Tariq help too. But some nights, all Tariq can do is hold his head and moan, his eyes bloodshot, his nose dripping. Laila sits with him when he's in the grip of it like that, rubs the back of his neck, takes his hand in hers, the metal of his wedding band cold against her palm. They married the day they arrived in Marie. Saeed looked relieved when Tariq told him they would. He would not have to broach with Tariq the delicate matter of an unmarried couple living in his hotel. Saeed is not at all as Laila had pictured him, ruddy-faced and pea-eyed. He has a salt-and-pepper mustache, whose ends he rolls to a sharp tip, and a shock of long gray hair combed back from the brow. He's a soft-spoken, mannerly man, with measured speech and graceful movements. It was Saeed who summoned a friend and a mullah for the nikah that day. Saeed who pulled Tariq aside and gave him money. Tariq wouldn't take it, but Saeed insisted. Tariq went to the mall then and came back with two simple, thin wedding bands. They married later that night, after the children had gone to bed. In the mirror, beneath the green veil that the mullah draped over their heads, Laila's eyes met Tariq's. There were no tears, no wedding day smiles, no whispered oaths of long-lasting love. In silence, Laila looked at their reflection, at faces that had aged beyond their years, at the pouches and lines and sags that now marked their once scrubbed, youthful faces. Tariq opened his mouth and began to say something, but just as he did, someone pulled the veil, and Laila missed what it was that he was going to say. That night, they lay in bed as husband and wife, as the children snored below them on sleeping cots. Laila remembered the ease with which they would crowd the air between them with words, she and Tariq, when they were younger. The haywire brisk flow of their speech always interrupting each other, tugging each other's collar to emphasize a point, the quickness to laugh, the eagerness to delight. So much had happened since those childhood days, so much that needed to be said. But that first night, the enormity of it all stole the words from her. That night, it was blessing enough to be beside him. It was blessing enough to know that he was here,
to feel the warmth of him next to her, to lie with him, their heads touching, his right hand laced in her left. In the middle of the night, when Lila woke up thirsty, she found their hands still clamped together, in the white-knuckle, anxious way of children clutching balloon strings. Lila likes Marie's cool, foggy mornings and its dazzling twilights, the dark brilliance of the sky at night, the green of the pines and the soft brown of the squirrels darting up and down the sturdy tree trunks, the sudden downpours that send shoppers in the mall scrambling for awning cover. She likes the souvenir shops, the various hotels that house tourists, even as the locals bemoan the constant construction, the expansion of infrastructure that they say is eating away at Marie's natural beauty. Lila finds it odd that people should lament the building of buildings. In Kabul, they would celebrate it. She likes that they have a bathroom, not an outhouse but an actual bathroom, with a toilet that flushes, a shower, and a sink too, with twin faucets from which she can draw with a flick of her wrist water, either hot or cold. She likes waking up to the sound of Aliona bleeding in the morning and the harmless cantankerous cook, Adiba, who works marvels in the kitchen. Sometimes, as Lila watches Tariq sleep, as her children mutter and stir in their own sleep, a great big lump of gratitude catches in her throat, makes her eyes water. In the mornings, Lila follows Tariq from room to room. Keys jingle from a ring clip to his waist, and a spray bottle of window cleaner dangles from the belt loops of his jeans. Lila brings a pail filled with rags, disinfectant, a toilet brush, and spray wax for the dressers. Aziza tags along, a mop in one hand, the bean-stuffed doll Mariam had made for her in the other. Zalmay trails them reluctantly, sulkily, always a few steps behind. Lila vacuums, makes the bed, and dusts. Tariq washes the bathroom sink and tub, scrubs the toilet, and mops the linoleum floor. He stocks the shelves with clean towels, miniature shampoo bottles, and bars of almond-scented soap. Aziza has laid claim to the task of spraying and wiping the windows. The doll is never far from where she works. Lila told Aziza about Tariq a few days after the nikah. It is strange, Lila thinks, almost unsettling, the thing between Aziza and Tariq. Already Aziza is finishing his sentences and he hers. She hands him things before he asks for them. Private smiles shoot between them across the dinner table as if they're not strangers at all, but companions reunited after a lengthy separation. Aziza looked down thoughtfully at her hands when Lila told her. "I like him," she said after a long pause. "He loves you." "He said that?" "He doesn't have to, Aziza." "Tell me the rest, mummy. Tell me so I know." And Lila did. "Your father is a good man. He's the best man I've ever known." "What if he leaves?" Aziza said. "He will never leave. Look at me, Aziza. Your father will never hurt you, and he will never leave." The relief on Aziza's face broke Lila's heart. Tariq has bought Zalmay a rocking horse, built him a wagon. From a prison inmate, he learned to make paper animals, and so he has folded, cut and tucked, countless sheets of paper into lions and kangaroos for Zalmay, into horses and brightly plumed birds. But these overtures are dismissed by Zalmay unceremoniously, sometimes venomously. "You're a donkey," he cries. "I don't want your toys." "Zalmay," Lila gasps. "It's all right," Tariq says. "Lila, it's all right, let him." "You're not my Baba John. My real Baba John is away on a trip, and when he gets back, he's going to beat you up. And you won't be able to run away, because he has two legs and you only have one." At night, Lila holds Zalmay against her chest and recites the Babalu prayers with him. When he asks, she tells him the lie again, tells him his Baba John has gone away and she doesn't know when he would come back. She abhors this task, abhors herself for lying like this to a child. Layla knows that this shameful lie will have to be told again and again. It will have to because Zaimai will ask, hopping down from a swing, waking from an afternoon nap, and later, when he's old enough to tie his own shoes, to walk to school by himself, the lie will have to be delivered again. At some point, Layla knows, the questions will dry up. Slowly, Zaimai will cease wondering why his father has abandoned him. He will not spot his father any longer at traffic lights, in stooping old men shuffling down the street, or sipping tea in open front at some of our houses. And one day it will hit him, walking along some meandering river or gazing out at an untracked snowfield, that his father's disappearance is no longer an open, raw wound, that it has become something else altogether, something more soft-edged and indolent, like a lore, something to be revered, mystified by. Layla is happy here in Marie, but it is not an easy happiness. It is not a happiness without cost. On his days off, Tariq takes Layla and the children to the mall, along which are shops that sell trinkets, and next to which is an Anglican church built in the mid-19th century. Tariq buys them spicy chabli kebabs from street vendors. They stroll amid the crowds of locals, the Europeans and their cellular phones and digital cameras, the Punjabis who come here to escape the heat of the plains. Occasionally, they board a bus to Kashmir Point. From there, Tariq shows them the valley of the Jhelum River, the pine-carpeted slopes, and the lush, densely wooded hills, where he says monkeys can still be spotted, hopping from branch to branch. They go to the maple-clad Natia Gali too, some 30 kilometers from Marie, where Tariq holds Layla's hand as they walk the tree-shaded road to the governor's house. They stop by the old British cemetery, or take a taxi up a mountain peak, for a view of the verdant, fog-shrouded valley below. Sometimes on these outings, when they pass by a store window, Layla catches their reflections in it. Man, wife, daughter, son. To strangers, she knows, they must appear like the most ordinary of families, free of secrets, lies, and regrets. Aziza has nightmares from which she wakes up shrieking. Layla has to lie beside her on the cot, dry her cheeks with her sleeve, soothe her back to sleep. Layla has her own dreams. In them, she's always back at the house in Kabul, walking the hall, climbing the stairs. She is alone, but behind the doors, she hears the rhythmic hiss of an iron, bedsheet snapped, then folded. Sometimes she hears a woman's low-pitched humming of an old Herati song. But when she walks in, the room is empty. There's no one there. The dreams leave Layla shaken. She wakes from them, coated in sweat, her eyes prickling with tears. It is devastating. Every time it is devastating. One Sunday that September, Layla is putting Zaimai, who has a cold, down for a nap when Tariq bursts into their bungalow. "Did you hear?" he says, panting a little. "They killed him. Ahmad Shah Massoud. He's dead." "What?" From the doorway, Tariq tells her what he knows. "They say he gave an interview to a pair of journalists who claimed they were Belgians originally from Morocco. As they're talking, a bomb hidden in the video camera goes off. Kills Massoud and one of the journalists. They shoot the other one as he tries to run. They're saying now the journalists were probably Al-Qaeda men." Layla remembers the poster of Ahmad Shah Massoud that Mami had nailed to the wall of her bedroom. Massoud leaning forward, one eyebrow cocked, his face furrowed in concentration, as though he was respectfully listening to someone. Layla remembers how grateful Mami was that Massoud had said a graveside prayer at her son's burial, how she told everyone about it. Even after war broke out between his faction and the others, Mami had refused to blame him. "He's a good man," she used to say. "He wants peace. He wants to rebuild Afghanistan, but they won't let him. They just won't let him." For Mami, even in the end, even after everything went so terribly wrong and Kabul lay in ruins, Masood was still the Lion of Panjshir. Laila is not as forgiving. Masood's violent end brings her no joy, but she remembers too well the neighborhoods razed under his watch, the bodies dragged from the rubble, the hands and feet of children discovered on rooftops, or the high branch of some tree days after their funeral. She remembers too clearly the look on Mami's own face moments before the rocket slammed in, and much as she has tried to forget, Bobby's headless torso landing nearby. The bridge tower printed on his t-shirt, poking through thick fog and blood. "There's going to be a funeral," Tariq is saying. "I'm sure of it. Probably in Rawalpindi. It'll be huge." Zalmay, who was almost asleep, is sitting up now, rubbing his eyes with balled fists. 2 days later, they're cleaning a room when they hear a commotion. Tariq drops the mop and hurries out. Laila tails him. The noise is coming from the hotel lobby. There's a lounge area to the right of the reception desk, with several chairs and two couches, upholstered in beige suede. In the corner, facing the couches, is a television, and Saeed, the concierge, and several guests are gathered in front of it. Laila and Tariq work their way in. The TV is tuned to BBC. On the screen is a building, a tower, black smoke billowing from its top floors. Tariq says something to Saeed, and Saeed is in mid-reply when a plane appears from the corner of the screen. It crashes into the adjacent tower, exploding into a fireball that dwarfs any ball of fire that Laila has ever seen. A collective yelp rises from everyone in the lobby. In less than 2 hours, both towers have collapsed. Soon all the TV stations are talking about Afghanistan and the Taliban and Osama bin Laden. "Did you hear what the Taliban said?" Tariq asks. "About bin Laden?" Aziza is sitting across from him on the bed, considering the board. Tariq has taught her to play chess. She's frowning and tapping her lower lip now, mimicking the body language her father assumes when he's deciding on a move. Zalmay's cold is a little better. He's asleep, and Laila is rubbing Vicks on his chest. "I heard," she says. "The Taliban have announced that they won't relinquish bin Laden because he is a Maimon, a guest, who has found sanctuary in Afghanistan, and it is against the Pashtun Wali code of ethics to turn over a guest." Tariq chuckles bitterly, and Laila hears in his chuckle that he is revolted by this distortion of an honorable Pashtun custom, this misrepresentation of his people's ways. A few days after the attacks, Laila and Tariq are in the hotel lobby again. On the TV screen, George W. Bush is speaking. There's a big American flag behind him. At one point, his voice wavers, and Laila thinks he's going to weep. Saeed, who speaks English, explains to them that Bush has just declared war. "On whom?" Tariq says. "On your country, to begin with." "It may not be such a bad thing," Tariq says. They have finished making love. He's lying beside her, his head on her chest, his arm draped over her belly. The first few times they tried, there was difficulty. Tariq was all apologies, Laila all reassurances. There are still difficulties, not physical now, but logistical. The shack they share with the children is small. The children sleep on cots below them, and so there's little privacy. Most times, Laila and Tariq make love in silence, with controlled, muted passion, fully clothed beneath the blanket as a precaution against interruptions by the children. They are forever wary of the rustling sheets, the creaking bedsprings. But for Laila, being with Tariq is worth weathering these apprehensions. When they make love, Laila feels anchored, she feels sheltered. Her anxieties that their life together is a temporary blessing, that soon it will come loose again in strips and tatters, are allayed. Her fears of separation vanish. "What do you mean?" she says now.
What's going on back home? It may not be so bad in the end.
Back home, bombs are falling once again, this time American bombs. Lila has been watching images of the war every day on the television as she changes sheets and vacuums. The Americans have armed the warlords once more and enlisted the help of the Northern Alliance to drive out the Taliban and find bin Laden. But it rankles Lila, what Tariq is saying. She pushes his head roughly off her chest.
Not so bad. People dying? Women, children, old people? Homes destroyed again? Not so bad?
Shh! You'll wake the children.
How can you say that, Tariq? She snaps. After the so-called blunder in Karam? 100 innocent people. You saw the bodies for yourself.
No, Tariq says. He props himself up on his elbow, looks down at Lila.
You misunderstand. What I meant was...
You wouldn't know, Lila says.
She's aware that her voice is rising, that they're having their first fight as husband and wife.
You left when the Mujahideen began fighting, remember? I'm the one who stayed behind. Me. I know war. I lost my parents to war. My parents, Tariq. And now to hear you say that war isn't so bad?
I'm sorry, Lila. I'm sorry.
He cups her face in his hands.
You're right, I'm sorry. Forgive me. What I meant was that maybe there will be hope at the other end of this war. That maybe for the first time in a long time...
I don't want to talk about this anymore,
Lila says, surprised at how she has lashed out at him. It's unfair, she knows, what she said to him. Hadn't war taken his parents too? And whatever flared in her is softening already. Tariq continues to speak gently, and when he pulls her to him, she lets him. When he kisses her hand, then her brow, she lets him. She knows that he's probably right. She knows how his comment was intended. Maybe this is necessary. Maybe there will be hope when Bush's bombs stop falling. But she cannot bring herself to say it, not when what happened to Bobby and Mami is happening to someone now in Afghanistan. Not when some unsuspecting girl or boy back home has just been orphaned by a rocket as she was. Lila cannot bring herself to say it. It's hard to rejoice. It seems hypocritical, perverse. That night, Zalmay wakes up coughing. Before Lila can move, Tariq swings his legs over the side of the bed. He straps on his prosthesis and walks over to Zalmay, lifts him up into his arms. From the bed, Lila watches Tariq's shape moving back and forth in the darkness. She sees the outline of Zaimai's head on his shoulder, the knot of his hands at Tariq's neck, his small feet bouncing by Tariq's hip. When Tariq comes back to bed, neither of them says anything. Lila reaches over and touches his face. Tariq's cheeks are wet. For Lila, life in Marie is one of comfort and tranquility. The work is not cumbersome, and on their days off, she and Tariq take the children to ride the chairlift to Patriada Hill, or go to Pindi Point, where, on a clear day, you can see as far as Islamabad and downtown Rawalpindi. There, they spread a blanket on the grass and eat meatball sandwiches with cucumbers and drink cold ginger ale. It is a good life, Lila tells herself, a life to be thankful for. It is, in fact, precisely the sort of life she used to dream for herself in her darkest days with Rashid. Every day, Lila reminds herself of this. Then, one warm night in July 2002, she and Tariq are lying in bed, talking in hushed voices about all the changes back home. There have been so many. The coalition forces have driven the Taliban out of every major city, pushed them across the border to Pakistan, and to the mountains in the south and east of Afghanistan. ISAF, an international peacekeeping force, has been sent to Kabul. The country has an interim president now, Hamid Karzai. Lila decides that now's the time to tell Tariq. A year ago, she would have gladly given an arm to get out of Kabul, but in the last few months, she has found herself missing the city of her childhood. She misses the bustle of Shor Bazaar, the gardens of Babur, the call of the water carriers, lugging their goatskin bags.